Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glass Lewis Proxy Talk. Before we get started, I'd like to remind everyone that our conference call series, and this call in particular, should not be considered a solicitation of proxies by Glass Lewis & Co. Glass Lewis has not sought permission to do so from the Securities and Exchange Commission, nor will it. This call is for information purposes only and should not be construed as providing investment advice. In addition, Glass Lewis makes no representation or warranty regarding the accuracy, completeness, or reliability of any statement, information, opinion, or view presented by its guest speakers. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded and will be available on the Glass Lewis website.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. I'm Courtney Keating, the Director of Environmental, Social, and Governance Research at Glass Lewis. Today, we're going to be discussing a number of climate change shareholder proposals that have or that will be going to vote during the 2017 proxy season. Climate change has been at the forefront of a lot of investors' minds in recent years, and accordingly, we've seen a fairly significant uptick in the number of shareholder resolutions requesting increased disclosure on how companies are handling the risks associated with this issue. And the 2017 proxy season has been no exception to this trend. We're seeing more and more companies being targeted with resolutions requesting that they provide shareholders with reporting or take some sort of action in order to mitigate their climate change-related impacts. In addition, these proposals are receiving increasing levels of support. Already this year, we've seen proposals that AES, Ameren, and Marathon Petroleum receive over 40% shareholder support. I think this is an especially pertinent and interesting topic to be discussing right now, given recent political events. There appears to be a bit of a dichotomy happening in the U.S. at the moment in that the government is rolling back climate change regulations and even threatening America's continuing participation in the Paris Accord. However, at the same time, investors appear to be challenging companies more and more on this issue. More of them are supporting climate change-related resolutions, and a growing number of mainstream investors are very publicly discussing their views on how climate change can present significant risks to their investments. There also seems to be a fairly significant difference in how companies and shareholders are addressing this issue in the U.S. and in Europe. With me, we have Ann Simpson, Investment Director of Sustainable Investing at the California Public Employees Retirement System, Michael Garland, who is the Assistant Comptroller of Corporate Governance and Responsible Investment for the Office of the New York City Comptroller, Helen Wildsmith, who is the Stewardship Director of Climate Change at CCLA, and finally, we have Edward Mason, who is the head of responsible investment at the Church Commissioners of England. And as a reminder, if at any point you have questions regarding today's call, please feel free to reach out to us at proxytalk@glasslewis.com. So now I'll turn it over to our speakers. Anne, let's start with you.
Well, thank you very much for the chance to talk about the work that CalPERS is doing on climate change. I'd like to explain why we're viewing this as a long-term investment risk and also a source of opportunity in our portfolio. As many of you know, CalPERS is a $300 billion plus fund, and our liabilities are very long term. They run for the best part of a century. And when we're thinking about our global exposure and the systemic risks that we're exposed to, climate change is increasingly at the top of our agenda, because we do see climate change as posing the systemic risk which can affect our portfolio returns. I mean, we only have to look at some of the potential impact on sea level rises, on the melting of Arctic caps, extreme weather events, drought, and changes in patterns of weather. This will affect, to some degree, all sectors of the portfolio. So the approach that we're taking is really to better understand these long-term risks that companies face, and also to look at the issue of the transition, because the Paris Accord on climate change, which we support strongly, provides a framework for companies to reposition their strategy. It has an ambition that global warming should be held to less than 2 degrees. And if that's going to happen, then the energy sector is going to undergo a profound transformation. So we're looking at how climate change will actually affect companies, for example, through sea level rise. But we're also interested in how we can ensure that the emissions that companies are producing can be driven down within that less than 2 degrees goal. So this sounds like a daunting task for an investor, but I would like to highlight that we did an analysis of our carbon footprint under the PRI's Montreal Pledge, and we found that about 100 companies globally are responsible for about half the emissions in our portfolio. The portfolio is 11,000 companies in close to 50 different markets. So it may be a pretty good proxy for the private sector internationally. So what we want to do is make sure first that we understand how companies are planning for the transition. And the proposals that we are carrying out proxy solicitations this year for are all companies that are on that global 100 list of what we're calling systemically important carbon emitters. And these proposals are right at the heart of investor risk and return considerations, because they're asking for the reporting, for the scenario analysis, for the strategy reporting, which is going to enable us to see as long-term owners how boards are responding. So we are running proxy solicitations at over a dozen companies in the United States. We're co-filing at several companies, and we're starting to see some really impressive levels of investor support, really as this climate change issue is being understood as a mainstream investment issue. So we're appealing for your support again this season. We hope that all investors will look at this as something valuable for their investment risk and return considerations. It really, really is part of our fiduciary duty to make sure we understand this. Thank you.
Great. Dan, thanks so much. Now I'll turn it over to Edward for his opening remarks.
Yes, hello. Thanks very much, Courtney. So I'm Edward Mason. I'm the head of responsible investment at the Church Commissioners in London. And we've been very much involved in engagement and shareholder resolutions on climate change in the oil and gas and mining sectors. At the moment, I'm particularly focused on an Exxon two-degree scenario analysis resolution that we've co-filed in partnership with New York State Common Retirement Fund. And it's also been co-filed by CalPERS and New York City on the call today. It's item 12 on the Exxon ballot. And there's really an unprecedented amount of support for this resolution from investors. It's been co-filed by a group of investors with around about $5 trillion of assets altogether. That's investors from North America and Europe, including some very big investor names from asset management like Amundi and HSBC Global Asset Management. I think we're at the stage now where two-degree scenario analysis resolutions are really getting as mainstream as something like proxy access. We've seen very high levels of support this year, as we did last year. We've seen the request for scenario analysis backed by the boards of companies in Europe, from BP, Shell and Total to UK-listed mining companies. We've seen the request backed by the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures set up by the Financial Stability Board. So I think, I mean, for us, the case for supporting Exxon Item 12 really couldn't be stronger. Two-degree scenario analysis is, as I say, absolutely mainstream, and it's really an essential component of investors understanding the climate risk that they're exposed to. And Exxon is very much a laggard amongst its supermajor peers. It's now the only supermajor that hasn't agreed to climate scenario analysis. And it's also the only supermajor that won't engage with investors at board level on climate risk.
Thanks, Edward. That's really great context for us. And now I will turn it over to Mike.
Thank you, Courtney. The New York City pension funds were a $175 billion system, broadly invested, a very long-term investor, similar to CalPERS. And we recognize that climate change presents risks across our portfolio. In some cases, those risks may be poorly understood or difficult to price, but certainly both the risk relating to physical impacts as well as transition risk affects virtually every company in some way, to greater or lesser extents. But certainly the transition risks are, I think, particularly acute for companies that tied to fossil fuel, so the oil and gas companies and the utilities that I know are the focus of the 2-degree proposals. And we've taken a comprehensive approach to how we think about assessing and managing climate risk at our companies, and really starting with the board, and it really informed our push for proxy access in the energy industry, and an emphasis on making sure that we have climate competent boards, that a diverse mix of relevant skills and experience in the boardroom to oversee the key risks facing the company, and particularly long-term risks that management may not be as focused on, like climate risk. And a key part of assessing whether we have a climate competent board is understanding, based on what the company's disclosing to us, how the board is overseeing risk. And I think the task force on climate-related financial disclosure provides a useful framework for assessing the core elements of robust climate-related financial disclosures. And if you look at that report, they talk about governance and how the board is overseeing climate risk, disclosures with respect to strategy, and the actual and potential impacts of climate change on a company's strategy, risk management, and then risks, metrics and targets, and both what the board is looking at as well as what the board is providing to investors. And a key recommendation from the task force is that companies disclose how they analyze different climate-related scenarios, including specifically under a 2-degree scenario, among others. And, in seeing many of the opposition statements and engaging with companies, some companies have told us that they don't believe that that's a likely scenario. And the point of a scenario analysis isn't whether or not it is likely or a most likely scenario. It's certainly a plausible scenario, and it's incumbent upon the board to understand how resilient and robust the company is under that scenario. And there are obviously various assumptions and pathways that go with each scenario analysis. And I think coming out of Paris, there's certainly global political will to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. And so as investors, we think it's critically important that boards prepare this analysis, review it, and disclose the results and the underlying assumptions.
Thank you, Mike. That's really helpful. And now I'll turn it over to Helen for her opening remarks.
Thank you, Courtney. And I just wanted to really talk about the developments that we're seeing in Europe. And firstly, just to let people know that the Aiming for A initiative, which led the BP and Shell and the mining resolutions that Edward mentioned, has now merged into the Institutional Investors Group on Climate Change here in Europe, a sister organization to the Ceres Investor Network. And as well as being Climate Stewardship Director at CCLA, I'm the first chair of the resolution subgroup at IIGCC. We don't have any resolutions in Europe this year. We're allowing everybody within the different structures to align themselves with each other, but very much continuing the engagement with the oil and gas majors over here and the mining companies, following on from the board-backed resolutions in both 2015 and 2016. And I'm glad to say that we've partnered on a new report with our sister organization, the Ceres Investor Network, and CDP, building on the oil and gas reports that came out in November, including the new expectations document that reflects the FSB's task force. And we're seeing progress in Europe amongst the various companies where we filed or had different agreements in terms of progress. For example, at BP, we have seen much more disclosure in terms of the technology outlook being publicly available for the first time, a 450 parts per million scenario called the Even Faster Transition in this year's Energy Outlook, and all of BP's scenarios being used in the strategy update that they announced this year, and that strategic intent being reflected in the remuneration policy, which goes to the vote at this year's AGM. We've still got work to do, and a lot of that work is about making sure that the companies going forward are disclosing in line with the TCFD once it's gone through the G20, and encouraging the companies to make more information readily available about how they're linking in the KPIs and the incentives to make sure the transition is done at the appropriate pace, and indeed making sure that the companies are playing a very proactive role in terms of global public policy, particularly on issues like carbon pricing.
Great. Thank you so much, Helen, for that international perspective. It's great for some of us that have been focused a lot on U.S. companies this year. So I'd actually like to turn a question over to Anne. And, you know, Mike, maybe you can jump in on this a bit. How have the proposals that we've seen in 2017 changed from the proposals that we saw last year? You know, have there been any significant changes? And if so, why were those changes made over the last year?
Thanks very much. I think the big wave of proposals was initially driven by the agreement that was reached under the Paris Accord. And the report, and you know, some of the proposals had to be filed for before that was even agreed. That was, you know, the year before last. What we saw last year is we had the benefit of a new task force being established by the Financial Stability Board, which is the club of the world's central bankers, whose chairman, Mark Carney, set out clearly in an important speech that financial markets' safety and soundness could be affected by transition risk under climate change. And with the support of the G20, this task force that was formed was drawn together in order to start setting out what would look like a sound reporting framework, thinking about climate change from a financial markets perspective. And the advice which the task force set out in draft form really gave impetus to the shareholder proposals that have been crafted this season, because what we're seeing is some shared interest between investors and financial market bank regulators in making sure we've got the right framework. And this advice, which will be shortly, we hope, endorsed by the G20 this summer, has four components. One is setting out the governance framework, which we all support. We want, and you know, New York City and CalPERS have both argued the importance of having a climate competent board. So governance is part one. Secondly, strategy. And of course, that's forward looking and it should be long term. Thirdly, risk management, which hardly needs any explanation, the risk management, but also the task force focuses on opportunity, the opportunities that companies have. And finally, the important point about disclosing metrics and targets. And I'll hand over to Mike to explain where that sets the stage for the scenario reporting, which he touched on.
Thank you, Anne. Well, I would just build further on exactly what Anne was describing in terms of the TCFD recommendations, because the report goes into quite a bit of depth around the importance of scenario analysis. I think it makes the point that, you know, this is not some new development, new tool. Scenario analyses are well established. It's what is new is the recognition that and importance of using scenario analysis in the context of climate change. And as a technical supplement to the TCFD report, there's a specific technical supplement on the use of scenario analysis in the disclosure of climate-related risks and opportunities. The task force is explicit about the importance, particularly in the fossil fuel sector, among others, to do an intensive scenario analysis, because in some sectors where it may be less important, the robustness of that analysis may not need to be as intensive. So I would encourage investors and issuers to look at the guidance that TCFD has provided, because they really provide a roadmap, and you know, whether it's a well-resourced company that can develop its own scenarios or less resourced companies that can rely on pre-existing scenarios to test their own robustness and resiliency of their strategy and their portfolio.
So I think we could agree that the TCFD could be viewed as a success that's occurred over the last year, and the guidance that has brought about. But I'm curious if there have been any other successes over the last year as a result of the proposals that were put forth in 2016. I know a number of them received quite high support. So I'm curious, Mike, if you know of any companies that have dramatically increased their disclosure as a result, or if we've seen any other successes.
I think there are lots of developments and successes, whether it's Suncor, which I think may be the first U.S. company, or is Suncor Canadian, to actually support the resolution that was filed calling for a scenario analysis. We've seen very high votes, I think typically in the 40 to 48%. Range so far this year. We've seen withdrawal of the proposal at a number of companies, including Chevron, based on developments. I do think, and I'll defer to my European colleagues on the phone, that the European majors are ahead of the curve in terms of their actual disclosures to date and responsiveness to investors. Mm.
Yeah, I'll just add a couple of points from the US. I agree with Mike's comment. I think in the European setting, there's a much stronger set of shareholder rights. Engagement and dialogue is better established. So we've actually got, a steeper climb in the United States. But given how important the energy sector is in the US on the global picture, we've got a lot to do. With that said, where we don't have the same toolkit of shareholder rights, and also there isn't the same long tradition of engagement in the US. A couple of other, I think, examples of where investors are having impact are several companies where proposals, Anadarko's one last year, ConocoPhillips, and this year Chevron, where companies have made commitments or have started down the reporting path and committed to continue engaging. And on that basis, shareholder proposals have been withdrawn. So that's a really positive sign of the impact investors are having. And I also see, even at Exxon, which Edward mentioned, is an important focus this season. Exxon, since the very high vote last year on climate risk, and I think also, you know, credit to New York City here, having investors won proxy access, we saw Exxon appointing a climate scientist to the board, Dr. Susan Avery, which really is a welcome, I think, response to the concern investors have expressed about whether the board has the skills and experience to be climate competent, as the phrase goes. Another example, I think, of responsiveness at Exxon is, and I believe this was at the CCLA's request, among others, Exxon issued a statement the day the Paris Agreement came into force on November the 4th to say, we support this. Furthermore, several days later, there was a new administration in the United States, and the incoming president had and has made comments which are skeptical about the value of the Paris Agreement. Exxon, you know, have shared with us and with others a letter which they wrote to the White House in response to the White House's request for advice, should we pull out of the Paris Agreement? And Exxon made a very compelling argument for why the U.S. should stay in the Paris Agreement, that this was actually going to be good for U.S. competitiveness And it was also going to give lots of opportunity, not just management of risk, which in itself is a good thing. And among the opportunities they wanted to highlight were the billions that they're investing in carbon capture technology, which they think has a lot of potential for their business. So that's just an example, I think, of now that the door's open for this conversation, we're seeing different approaches on the policy agenda, as well as better reporting on capital allocation. I also wanted to quickly flag, I think, something else that investors, long-term investors, need to watch, which is where companies have developed a very well thought through sustainability strategy. And I'm thinking of NRG here. We need to make sure that the company can protect its long-term objectives. And NRG now has two hedge fund directors on the board. We happen not to support either of them because of our concern about the short term. But I think as companies commit to these long-term transitions, we also, as owners, need to protect boards when they come under short-term pressure. Because this is a complex and a long-term transition, and companies just won't get there if they don't have support.
Thanks so much, Anne. And just a reminder to listeners that we actually did a separate proxy talk on the NRG board issue with our very own Mike Garland. So if anybody is curious and wants more information, they can find information on that on our blog. So you'd spoken a bit about Exxon, and Edward, I know that your organization has been one of the co-filers of the resolution there this year, like you said. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about the progress you've made with them, if any, over the last year, and kind of why you're re-proposing this proposal.
I mean, I think the key point is that we do not file these shareholder resolutions in isolation without engagement. So we were very pleased with the strong show of support that we got last year on the equivalent resolution. And that got 38% support at the shareholder vote at the meeting last year. And we used that as a platform to embark on engagement. And we worked with many of the major investors that supported the resolution last year and had some significant exchanges with Exxon. As Anne said, one of the positive things that came out of that in particular was an advance in Exxon's public policy position with regard to the Paris Agreement. So we were very pleased to see that. But unfortunately, we haven't made progress on the key ask of 2-degree scenario analysis. And I think This happens in engagement, and this happens in interactions with companies, that sometimes things get stuck. And this is where shareholder signals become extremely important, particularly when a company has sort of fallen behind what its peers are doing in engagement with an issue and in reporting on an issue. So that's why we've refiled the resolution. It's why we've garnered even more co-filing support this year, with the support of over 50 investors co-filing. And we've already had further investors with over $5 trillion of assets under management signaling that they will be supporting the resolution, so pre-declaring their support even at this very early stage. And that includes very major investors like Legal & General Investment Management. So yes, we've made progress with Exxon, but we haven't made progress on 2-degree scenario analysis, and that's why this vote is so important. And I think we've all made reference to the TCFD recommendations. One thing that hasn't come out yet is that the TCFD did a consultation on its recommendations and how useful people would find them. And on the specific question of 2-degree scenario analysis, 75% of financial sector respondents to the consultation said they would find climate scenario analysis useful or very useful. So that's 75% of respondents there from the financial sector. Interestingly, only 2% of financial sector respondents said that climate scenario analysis would not be useful at all. So this is really something that investors are demanding.
And Courtney, it's Mike. I just want to weigh in very briefly, because I do think that Exxon's resistance to providing the conducting and disclosing a 2-degree scenario analysis is surprising, particularly, you know, a company with the sophistication and resources of a company like Exxon. I mentioned earlier that, you know, Suncor supported the proposal. What I didn't mention is, you know, Suncor is a relatively small company, and you know, it developed its 2-degree scenarios based on publicly available scenarios. It used a combination of the IHS market scenarios, the IEA scenarios, and actually did an assessment of the impact of those scenarios on its complete portfolio of resources, not just on oil and gas. And I think if a company like Suncor can take that step, certainly Exxon has the capacity, and I think the board has the responsibility to do that on behalf of the company and its investors.
Absolutely. Thanks for that insight. We've spent a fair amount of time talking about Exxon, but I'm curious if maybe, Anne, you could get into some other companies that have been targeted by the proposal this year and why those companies were chosen.
Thanks, Courtney. the starting point for us is this analysis that we've done on our portfolio to identify where we have high concentrations of risk due to carbon emissions. And this is built on an important project that Ceres launched several years ago called the Carbon Asset Risk Initiative. And what Ceres did, which was extremely helpful, is identify the heavy emitters in the energy sector and utilities included, so that a dialogue could be established on the issue of oversight, governance oversight, strategy, reporting, and also, as Helen touched on earlier, the importance of compensation, incentives being aligned with, you know, a transition that's needed on climate change in this sector. What CalPERS did under the PRI Montreal Pledge was refine that analysis and make it global, so that we identified the 100 companies that are responsible for 50% of the portfolio emissions in the CalPERS publicly listed companies, the 11,000 companies in about 47 markets. So that has really given us an absolute laser focus on the companies which are, because they are responsible for such heavy emissions, first of all, they're posing a risk in the portfolio. And it's one reason we think divestment is not going to address climate change risk in our portfolio. The emissions levels themselves need to be brought in line with the Paris Agreement if we're going to have some chance of keeping to the less than 2 degrees goal, under which there is a possibility for normal or economic, we can adapt to the physical impact of climate change, we think. If it gets to higher temperatures, then, you know, the risks of a chaotic transition and impact on communities and the economies and the companies, it's actually looking very uncertain and very concerning. So the selection of the companies is related to this idea of systemically important carbon emitters. Those companies worldwide which are having a measurable impact on climate change because of their heavy carbon emissions. So if these companies can get their strategies in line with Paris, we'll actually make real progress towards meeting those targets. So we'll benefit as investors, or we plan to, because of the risks being managed and the opportunities being opened up. But we also see this systemic benefit because those emissions are causing impact on other companies and other sectors. So the selection process really has been focused on, if you like, materiality. Where is there material climate risk in the portfolio? You know, and we work, as I said, very closely through the Ceres Investor Network and the other regional networks around the world to make sure that we're pooling ideas, but also developing this strategic approach. It's not hit and miss. There's nothing random about this. It's all been very carefully analyzed.
Is the Aiming for A coalition targeting any European companies this year, or do you have a focus this year, Helen?
We're actually continuing the engagement with the people that we filed at 2016 and 2015. And we're doing quite a lot of work in preparation for thinking about possible resolutions in the electrical utilities sector in years to come once we see how the task force work lands. And we're also working to make sure that some of the systemic issues are being addressed in terms of encouraging people to work together. So you mentioned earlier that most of the rankings show that the European oil and gas majors are ahead of the North American peers. And certainly the analysis that CDP, the former Carbon Disclosure Project, released in November showed that. And I think part of that is because we've encouraged the oil and gas majors here to come together under the Oil and Gas Climate Initiative. And all the majors at this side of the Atlantic are members of that, alongside four national oil companies. And it does mean that they're working together on various initiatives in terms of some of the things they have to do themselves collectively, but also how they engage with the policy context. And we're also seeing some of the companies that we've engaged with through Aiming for AIS historically, like BHP Billiton and Shell, coming together under the auspices of the Energy Transition Commission, where we're seeing actors from different sectors, including academics and others, working together to puzzle through how we get through this complex multi-decade low-carbon transition. And you've also got some of the world's biggest investors, HSBC, BlackRock, involved in that too.
So I know you said that you're working right now with the original kind of Aiming for A companies, and I'm curious how those companies are coming along as far as their commitments are going. I know particularly with respect to BP, there had been some focus on the company's compensation, for example, and how that's aligning with their goals to mitigate certain climate change risks. So could you talk a bit about how that progress is coming and kind of what the companies are up to with respect to this issue?
Yes, no, definitely. And but probably your listeners will recall that at BP's AGM in 2016, there was a vote against the remuneration report. So BP have done very extensive outreach with investors as they've been developing their forward-looking policy, which goes to the binding vote at the 2017 AGM, and in line with the resolutions that were backed by the board in 2015, one of the points we made was that as the companies start to do their portfolio resilience work, start to embed that in their strategic thinking, that this needs to be reflected in KPIs and remuneration. And we were very pleased to see that BP have factored in their strategic priorities into remuneration going forward. So the fact that they're prioritising gas, advantaged oil, their alternative energy business, and the venturing across various potential opportunities within the low carbon space, that is going to be reflected within remuneration. And there's also an environmental underpin which will allow them to reflect the more operational aspects, whether that relates to good carbon dioxide or whether it relates to methane emissions.
So, Edward, I'd like to turn it back over to you. I know Helen's spoken a bit about some of the companies that Aiming for A has worked with. Have you noticed any notable differences in how European and U.S. investors are thinking or acting when engaging with companies on climate change-related issues and perhaps even voting on climate change-related proposals?
Yes, I mean, I think we're seeing kind of universal concern about climate risk and engagement with underlying companies on this. And you only need to look at, say, BlackRock's participation in the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, their two white papers on climate risk, to sort of see that, you know, it's happening on both sides of the Atlantic, and is very much a kind of consistent and mainstream view. I think that, you know, the kind of interest in greater disclosure and the sort of requirement for it is expressed in different ways. And I think there can be sort of more willingness on the part of European investors to back shareholder resolutions in the face of management opposition. You know, I think it was quite striking that the aiming for A resolutions at BP and Shell and the mining companies were all sort of passed with overwhelming support at sort of 95% through to 99% at Statoil. And that was when boards recognized the value of the resolutions management recommended to shareholders to support them, and shareholders did. And we've seen that, you know, there can be a reluctance to sort of challenge boards on the part of some investors. But I think, you know, that's something that that we are seeing changing, and we're getting a very strong expression from many major asset managers now that this is something that, you know, they are prepared to stand up for, even in the face of management reluctance. So, you know, as I say, I mentioned the level of co-filing support that we've had this year from very significant investors, and we've seen major global investors like the Norwegian Government Pension Fund change their policies so that they're able to start pre-declaring their support for votes like this. And I think our experience in Europe is that this kind of shareholder signaling has really tremendous value. Helen has talked about kind of what it's meant at BP. You know, there are many other examples as well. Total, for example, has you know, produced an excellent climate change report. It uses the IEA 450 scenario. That's the IEA's 2 degrees scenario as its baseline for developing its future strategy. And as Helen says, the European supermajors are very much engaged on public policy. So these signals from shareholders do matter. They do achieve progress in companies' engagement with climate change. So I think the trend is very clear towards you know, more assertive shareholder action on this. I think it's, you know, you can see clearly from this call that we have asset owners who, you know, for whom the system is ultimately designed are very clear about their concerns about climate risk across their portfolio and the need for transition. And you know, this is what you know, we need to see increasingly driving the system and an expression of investor views on climate change.
Thank you so much. So finally, I'd like to turn it over to Anne, and maybe Mike, you can share your thoughts on this as well. Here in the U.S., we've recently had a change in administration, and I'm curious how you're thinking on climate change risk has changed, if at all, since the election of Donald Trump and the likely significant rollback in climate change regulation, including the potential that the U.S. may back out of the Paris Accord.
yes, thank you. Certainly on the CalPERS side, we're viewing the climate change agenda as an investment issue, not as a regulatory or a compliance issue, and we're very focused on, first of all, the need for, as a fiduciary working in complex financial markets, to be sure that we're grounded in science. I think that opinion and ideology, comment, you know, it's important that there's always a free flow of ideas and an exchange of information, but you know, that it was some hundreds of years back. We moved from the flat Earth to an understanding of the solar system and our position in it, and the progress that's been made over time has been by understanding science and understanding evidence, understanding data. Now, that in science is very consistent with the way that investment analysis has to work. We do want to bring insight and questions and experience, but fundamentally, we're looking at the economics. And on some of the issues which the administration has commented on, we can see much greater economic forces at work. So even for the US, US companies are selling in global markets. You know, they're in trade agreements with companies, countries which are fully committed to the Paris Agreement. And I think, you know, the economic argument, as articulated so well by Exxon, a company very close to the administration, made a superb argument to the White House directly that it was in Exxon's interest and in the interest of American business to stay part of the Paris Accord. And I don't think you have a more eloquent voice on this topic, given that Exxon is the world's largest oil and gas company. And I certainly think this, in part at least, reflects the conversations that have been going on with investors who are not looking at climate change as something which blows with political winds, but something which is grounded on that powerful combination of science and economics. So I think it's very important that we keep ourselves focused on the long-term horizon, and we back companies in ensuring they've got sustainable strategies, because certainly for pension funds like CalPERS, like New York City and others, our pensioners need and our members need this transition to take place over decades, not over a political cycle. So we watch with caution. We've supported the Ceres, PRI, and other investor network statement arguing the case, the financial case for staying part of the Paris Agreement. And we hope that the G20 will endorse the good work of the Financial Stability Board's task force on climate change reporting. It certainly will be short. It will be short-sighted, and it may even have some adverse impact for US companies. You know, to go for short-term opportunities which in the long term aren't sustainable. I think the forces which have led to bankruptcy in the coal industry and, you know, severe financial pressure on some of the utilities relying on coal, this sort of dislocation is a sign that the financial markets are repositioning themselves for new sources of energy. And, you know, to fight that tide is to be, you know, in the legend of King Canute, who went down to the seashore to show his own courtiers that his power as a monarch was nothing compared to the forces of nature. And be it as much that he would command the waves to retreat, nothing happened. And I think that's a very poignant story from a long while back, which is that we have to understand that we need to work, you know, with the bigger forces in play. And certainly on this, there are forces of nature and being assessed through science, and we need to make an economic response to that, not a political response.
Thank you so much for that response. And Mike, I thought I'd just turn it over to you to see if there have been any, you know, change of thought or change of approach given the recent change of administration, and your thoughts on how you know your firm can kind of move forward given extenuating circumstances.
I would just echo what I think Anne articulated quite eloquently. You know, I really don't have much to add to that. I think very much aligned on that perspective. I'd make, you know, a couple maybe small points in support. I mean, I think certainly the shifting political landscape in the U.S. has galvanized investors and businesses, and we're seeing that today and yesterday, and whether it's the op-eds or the business community reaching out to the White House to caution them against the risk of pulling out of the Paris Agreement. But regardless of what happens, you know, in the immediate term in the U.S. political landscape and what the administration chooses to do, you know, market forces are already driving the transition, and companies are going to need to react to that. The Paris Agreement is in place. There's global political will, regardless of where the U.S. fits in, and the U.S. had been a leader. I hope we retain that posture. But there could be consequences for U.S. companies. I think, you know, we've heard talk of things like carbon-based tariffs imposed by those countries that remain in those countries, meaning the overwhelming majority of countries in the world that remain in the agreement. So the global marketplace is on that path. I think because of market forces and, frankly, global political forces, the U.S. will need to stay on that path. And the notion that companies would reassess risk based on, you know, changes in politics year to year, the notion of the scenario request is, under this scenario, which is a very plausible scenario, given that that's, you know, what global governments have come to agree upon, what does your company look like? What are the impacts? How resilient is your strategy and your portfolio of assets? And I don't think that analysis and understanding in the boardroom should change week to week or month to month.
Well, thank you so much to Michael Garland, Ann Simpson, Helen Wildsmith, and Edward Mason. I think this was a really, really interesting call, and I think this will be really, really helpful for investors as they're kind of looking at these votes at the upcoming meetings. And so, yeah, thank you so much for participating in the call. I know that this is a very busy time of year for you, so I appreciate you speaking to us about this. Listeners, if you would like a link to the audio or would like to view our show notes, please go to our website at glasslewis.com, and you can access the call on the Glass Lewis blog. For more information, please email proxytalk@glasslewis.com. And if there's ever an annual or special meeting coming up that you think warrants special attention and would merit some discussion with your colleagues, please don't hesitate to email us. Also, if you have comments about Proxy Talk that you wish to share with us, please send your feedback. It's always very much appreciated and will be taken to account as we structure our future calls. So thank you so much, everybody, and have a great day.